with me here. Boy, that a lot. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at in the U.S. or around the world. Thanks for joining us on Baseball Outside the Box. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. This is the show that loves to interview baseball's greatest coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. And we are going to start here in a minute. But before we do, remember, I always remind you, do me a favor. Please go to the podcast, baseballoutsidethebox.com. Subscribe. That's where the audio goes. And also YouTube. Go there to Peter Caliendo. Subscribe. That helps the show get out there. And we really appreciate it. We need your assistance. Without you, the show doesn't get out. Because of you, our listeners, the show is in 100 countries. We have listeners in 100 countries. We are proud of that. And that's all because of our listeners. You guys are fantastic. And of course, the people who watch it on live on Facebook and live on YouTube currently. If you're on Facebook and you have a question, please leave it in the comments section. We will get it in. All right, folks, hopefully you are healthy and safe and we are ready to rock and roll. Let me tell you, we're going to get into, again, you know, there's so many important topics, but we're going to get into pitching and we're going to get into biomechanics, the strength and conditioning part of it, the mental part, nutritional. I mean, there's so many aspects of being a top pitcher that we're going to talk about an individual who has an incredible background. You're going to hear it as we go along. Well known around the country, but her background is incredible. And simply because she marks all the boxes, and I'll give you the boxes that I think she marks, and she can tell me later. Biomechanics, exercise physiology, structural kinesiology, motor control and development, sports science. I mean, when you put it all together, I mean, you talk about somebody who can master teaching. This is going to be exciting. And I'm going to get into some other things she's done. She's got her master's in exercise science, her bachelor's in psychology, a published peer review, I can't even pronounce it, on engineering a strong pitching elbow. I'm going to ask her about that because there's so many injuries in the elbow area. So let me welcome, hey, folks, another good Italian. I apologize. I have a lot of Italians on the show. It's not because I'm favored to Italians. It's because they just happen to be good. We want to find great people. Let me welcome Angel Borelli. How you doing, Angel?
I'm fine, Pete. Thank you. Passion. Italians, we have passion.
Yes. Once in a while, I get a few emails because I have had quite a few Italians on the show. But you know what? And it's an interesting segue into what we're about to talk about because we're going to talk about pitching, but I want to get into your background a little bit because, you know, when I say, okay, there's another Italian on the show. What I mean is it just happens to be, you know, who's good and who's not. I mean, you know, if you're good, you're good. That's what I care about. I don't care really what nationality, what person, what gender, who you are. You can come from Mars, but if you're really good, you are good. Now, in saying that, now you've been a strength and conditioning coach for over 40 years. And all of a sudden in 1995, you get into, you know, working with pitchers. And we're talking about folks, not just pitchers in Little League, high school, college, professional, all levels. I mean, unbelievable. And I want to ask you because, you know, in 1995, when you first started, I mean, honestly, there weren't a lot of women in baseball, at least in the teaching aspect. Now, which is great because you're seeing women in the minor leagues, you're seeing women in the major leagues, and these are successful women that have got a great background. You're almost like the frontier part. You started all this in some ways. So I want to give our audience an idea what it was like at that time, because, and I apologize for talking long here, but you know, one of the things on your website, we talked off the air, it says, can a woman teach pitchers to improve? Well, you threw that out the window because, you know, you could teach anybody to improve pitching. So, I mean, you've taught men extremely well. So tell us your background a little bit, how this all started and how you got into it.
Well, I was a strength and conditioning coach working with athletes. And in 1995, I had a pitcher referred to me and he came to me. He was going to be drafted, his coach said, but he was always injured. And he ended up, by the way, being drafted. But he was at a junior college and the coach said, he referred him and said, I've heard about you. Can you train him and get him stronger? So I had never worked with pitching. So as a good strength coach, you go and you analyze the motion so that you can start to match exercises. Simultaneous to that, I had decided to go back to graduate school. So I'm like, this is great. I can use my studies to do the research. I'm going to kill two birds with one stone. Well, the second I started delving into it, and I was interviewing a pitcher, hearing what they do, I started noticing right away two things. One is I absolutely loved pitching. I absolutely loved the way this pitcher was wired. I'm like, this is a very special guy here. And then the other thing I said is, why am I reading in books certain things that they should be doing because of the type of athlete they are? But that's not what I see them doing. You know, for example, them running distance and not running in the way you would run because of the type of athlete you are. Things weren't meshing. So in 95, it wasn't really so much I'm a woman in baseball as pitchers shouldn't lift weights. Nobody runs sprints. I was bringing information to the table that people were like, what? And especially the training part. Because in those days, in 1995, I mean, now the pitchers are buffed, right? They're all lifting weights. But in 1995, no. And I was very lucky that as I got more into it, I went across the street to a junior college, and Rob Wilson, the best coach ever at that time, I went to him and I said, I'm a graduate student. I'm just starting to work with training programs for pitchers. Can I take your pitchers into the gym and onto the track? He said, take my whole team. Please take them. And I said, well, I want to do some innovative stuff. He said, I'm in. And that's how I got my start.
You know, that's awesome. And I want to mention, you got your start, but you also dropped an incredible career because you were very successful.
Right.
At the conditioning program.
Right. I had my own business. I was one-on-one. But I brought a different thing to the table so people knew I was really into what I was doing. I was always going to school, getting every type of certification I could. I had studied what's called structural integration, which is a form of Rolfing. It's a form of body work. We actually learn how to engineer the body's posture. I brought some things to the table that gave me a reputation. So when I got the pitcher referred to me, it was referred because they said, we know you'll know how to figure out what to do. So I was brand new with pitching. I didn't know a thing about it. I knew I liked to watch baseball, but I wasn't really. I was a strength coach embarking on just another skill that my athlete had. And it was so complex, the skill, that I knew right away that I loved it. And if I wanted to be good at it, I would have to start focusing. So I told all my other athletes, at that time they were all male athletes from all different walks of sports. And I said, from here on out, I'm only going to work with baseball pitchers. And that's what I did. Because I knew if I was going to do this, I had to devote every minute. And every minute I was working with a different skill, I was missing out on a minute where I could be doing research on pitching. So my whole plan in 95 was to be this best strength coach ever. And I was going to go to graduate school, which I had started, and I was going to learn enough to become the best strength coach ever. And it was after being such a great strength coach with pitchers that they started saying to me, Angel, your workouts are so precise. Could you come and look at me on the mound? And so there I was, and it took me another X number of years to get my master's because then I decided that I wanted to go into analysis. So that's how it started. They pulled me in, and it was great. And as far as being a female, I was such a geek that I didn't even think, like, I'm going to walk on a baseball field. I mean, I was like, you know, science has no sex. Passion has no sex. It's like when you're called and you're inspired, you almost have blinders on. When I look back now, I go, are you kidding? Did I actually do that? But I did it. I did it. I walked right on the field and I thought nothing of it. And I said, hey, give me your guys. I want to train them. I'll volunteer. And that's actually what happened. So Yeah, I wasn't like going, I'm a woman in baseball. I was like, this is what you follow your path. And I didn't even think twice about it.
Yeah, and you stayed, young people out there, if you got young coaches, you stayed focused, you took one area, which is pitching, you became an expert in it. But then to me, even more importantly, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you check all the boxes because, in order, and then this is just me speaking, and then I'm going to see what you think. But in order to teach pitching, everybody thinks it's just the mechanics. Well, sure. Okay. You got to have good biomechanical understanding, exercise physiology, some kinesiology, motor learning. Obviously that helps. You've got all these things, sports science, psychology, and strength and conditioning all coupled together, where now you can really, give a lot more information and work for that young pitcher than most people can, because a lot of people don't have this background.
Yes, it's so deep. It's down to the cellular level. And when I started graduate school, the very first professor I had, he said to me, Angel, he said, the knowledge that you'll get, he said, you're only as good as how deep your knowledge goes. And so every turn in graduate school, they'd say, well, Angel, you don't have to have chemistry. But if you have chemistry, you'll understand physiology better. So I'm sitting there going, he just said that. What am I going to say? Oh, I'm going to go around it. I don't want chemistry. I'm going, I'm going to be taking checks from people. People are going to be paying me. Would they want to hear me say, oh, no, professor, I'm going to take the short way around. I would rather graduate a year earlier and not take chemistry. I mean, once he said it, I'm like, okay, so I am, and as a student, I'm really good at what I do. But in chemistry and math and stuff like that, I was not. No, these things were hard for me. I had to have tutors, but I had to do it because specialization to me is everything. And this is, and I feel this way about kids that want to be pitchers. And then they tell me, I go, what do you play? Left field, right field, middle field, first base, second base, third base. I'm a catcher, I'm a pitcher. And I'm like, what's in your heart? Because if you don't get what's in your heart, how do you have time to focus? And sports are deep, and you're only as good as your own depth. So I found that to be true with me, and I feel that way about pitchers. If you're going to pitch, pitch. Don't get distracted. Be a specialist, because the things you miss when you don't focus, you don't know you missed them. So you think you have it, but you don't know you missed it.
On that,
yes.
On that, I'd like to ask, and you see me looking down because I'm looking at our Facebook page, case there's questions, a lot of people joining us. Thank you for joining us on Facebook, everybody. One of the couple questions, actually. One, because you mentioned the, identifying and becoming a pitcher. How early should you do that? Because of the fact that, when you're younger, if you're 9, 10, 11, 12, I mean, if you can play multiple positions, you don't know which one you like yet. What's your recommendation to get started?
Well, so first of all, there's so many ways to answer this. Let's talk about pitching. What doctors will tell you, when you go to the ASMI conference, which I go to the medical conferences, they'll tell you that when they go into a shoulder of a kid who's been pitching since he was like 7, mm-hmm. his shoulder is going to look completely different than the pitcher who started when he was 16. And the pitcher who started when he was 16 is probably going to get injured because his shoulder's already not developed in the way a pitcher's is. And I don't mean that they go in and they see a strained shoulder. They see accommodations. They see adaptations. So if you've got so that's one thing about finding your position. Now, in terms of playing many positions, it's very important to explore what the kid is good at. And this is where coaches can be so great. I mean, it's like if you've got a kid who should be a wrestler or he should be a football player and he's trying to be a baseball player, a good coach knows how to direct that and bring that out, because our job should be to put the right kid in the right place. But yes, on baseball, it's very important. But a lot of times positions are chosen for the child based on the coach's needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the coach's needs are, okay, parents, please don't send in tons of bad messages to Pete on this. The parents are in the coach's face about, I want my kid to play every day. And maybe this coach thinks this guy should be a PO. I mean, maybe he's thinking that at 11. The parents, I want my kid on the field and I think he can do this. So we've got the poor youth coach dealing with the parent, still trying to evaluate where everybody should go. And, you know, when you ask a youth coach, how many pitchers do you have? He says 11, you know, right? He's got 11 pitchers. I mean, everyone's a pitcher. So the thing is, there's so much that goes on. If we were to isolate, think of the countries, like the countries that win things, Russia, China, et cetera. They pick kids at an early age. They can tell by their body type. They can tell by their skill and also where their head is at with focusing on it. If you don't like it, you're not going to focus on it. If you don't like it, you're not going to be good at it. Most humans gravitate towards what they're good at. This is a tenet in psychology. I mean, you want to understand the person. And even little kids, they're little people. All the little guys on that baseball team, I always tell fathers, they're little men. That is you. That is you. And they're showing, you know, if they're crying when they get on the mound, that's not the kid. He gives up a walk and he starts crying. That's probably not a kid that's going to handle it, because basically you don't change your wiring emotionally. You can kind of calm it, but, you know, because, you know, you see a stud at 10 years old sometimes, you know, you look and say, man, that guy's got ice running in his veins and he's 10. And it's scary to see, but it's almost like they're almost born into it. So I think that there's a combination of things. But yes, exploring in the best way you can what skill the child is good at is critical. And what he's good at is what he'll gravitate towards.
Makes sense. Folks, do me a favor. Go to gymscience.com. Check out Angel Borelli's website. Incredible. Her podcast is there. A lot of great information. There's other, if you Google her name, you'll see a bunch of interviews she's done. You know, I want to go back a second because we really got to get it. We're going to get into a little bit more in depth here, but I want to get into two things you said. A lot of coaches, I think, at the higher levels pretty much understand this, but just in case, because we got coaches working with young kids also, when we talk about weightlifting and we talk about sprinting, remember those were two things we didn't do when I grew up because there right. wasn't science possibly behind it. Baseball didn't want to change. What's the benefit of those two things when it comes to pitching or anything else?
Well, first of all, when you have a child, so strength training is a very critical part of development of an athlete. The forces that he's producing on the mound are pretty intense. So the stronger the body, the better. And you know, it's not such an unusual thing these days. I mean, it's not unusual at all. Kids are lifting weights at early ages, but you have to understand what happens. You know, a boy doesn't have hormones. So when he trains and he's 10 or 11 years old, if he's working out, he has to be under the direct supervision of an adult the whole time. You don't send him in the gym. So it makes it almost like impossible to do. But if I get an 11-year-old, and I just had one 2 weeks ago, that has a serious injury, when he went back to flat ground throwing, he was hurting. And I said, that's because his elbow's not strong enough. Sometimes the skilled kids, their skill gets ahead of their body. So let's talk about high school for sure, and then all the others. Training is absolutely necessary. First of all, the injuries are insane with pitchers. And muscles are designed to protect the deep structures of the body. That's how we're designed. The bone and the ligaments are on the bottom level. The muscles lay over them. They make the limbs move. If your muscle gets fatigued, then it doesn't do its job. And then the ligament becomes damaged. That's why we have so many ligament injuries. Ligament injuries usually start, I mean, if you talk to pitchers, In fact, I know I've heard this. When they interview pitchers who have had UCL, these are major leaguers, they'll say, I was feeling forearm pain and fatigue for a while. That muscle was not doing its job to protect the structure. So when you train, you have to train correctly. And this is the reason why the deeper your knowledge goes, because when you're training, you can have an instructor that's overlaying an exercise and he doesn't even know why he's giving it to you. If you know more, you know exactly what joint needs what muscles to work, and you'll know the plane of motion. If you know even more, you'll know the type of contraction it needs. If you know even more, you're going to know what nutrition he needs because he needs size there. You'll know exactly the programming to do. You'll also know the type of running he should do to recruit the right fibers so that he becomes more powerful and not drained by the running he's doing. So the deeper your knowledge goes, you can go down to the cellular level and create a program where you're literally engineering a pitcher, which is what I do, luckily, with the pitchers that have been with me for years and the ones that stay with me. I literally, in my head, I'm thinking, I'm engineering them, correcting, fixing, so they can do what they do. I don't have to teach them pitching. They're good at it. I need them to get out of their way and need their body to become one with their skill because they're already gifted at what they do or they wouldn't be on the mound. Very rarely do you see a guy make it that really shouldn't be a pitcher. They're there for a reason. And I have the highest respect for that. So training is critical for pitchers and anybody in high school. The younger kids, it's questionable given who can supervise them, et cetera. But I did an experimental program with a group of boys that were 11 years old. No, they were 10 years old, and this was in 2007. I'm happy to say three of those kids are in the minor league system now. Most all the other kids stayed uninjured, but when you see them in the gym training, they know how to train. It was going to be an experimental one-year program, and they've been training ever since. And to have a kid, but I was supervising them. But as a high school, you have to lift weights because guess what? The other guy's doing it. Yeah. So you have to protect your body. And we have to get our heads around trying not to have these guys be injured.
Hey, Angel, I was going to say, you know, one of the things that's difficult for me, and you noticed a couple of times, I have a hard time pronouncing some of these words. And I got to ask you about cellular level. What does that mean, cellular level, when you talk about that level?
Well, your body is made up of, you've got tissue and you've got muscles and you've got tendons, but you've got cells inside of those muscles. You've got millions of cells in your body, and the cells make up the fibers that make up the tissue, that make up the contractile mechanism, that make up the muscle. I'm being extremely like general about it, but cells are little tiny little microscopic things that they come together and they create whatever it is that they are a part of. And cells and fibers, for example, when a strength coach says to a pitcher, I want you to run 40s out of the track, mm-hmm. and I want you to get full recovery. And then when you're ready to go, you're going to run full out again, full recovery. That strength coach is working on a level that is a fiber level, the fiber inside the muscle, not the muscle level, the fiber level. That strength coach is remodeling and trying to build and create the type of fiber structure that will allow that muscle to be powerful. The strength coach that doesn't know that much and just says pitchers need to run, guys, I want you to go out and run a mile. And I want you to run it as fast as you can because he's thinking, oh, I want him to have endurance or something. You're making that fiber slow, you're training the wrong type of fiber, you're creating the wrong kind of chemistry and you're making that pitcher slower. So the knowledge about physiology, the muscle, the fiber inside the muscle, and how all those things respond to training, because training is something you're putting onto your system and it's going to produce a result. And different training, for example, a bodybuilder trains to make a muscle big. Mm-hmm. Somebody who wants to be strong, he wants a big muscle, but then he has to convert that into being strong. It's a different type of training. So somebody telling you to do 16 reps, that has a totally different result than someone who's training with a 5 to 7 rep range and he's lifting heavier weights. That's what I mean by going down deeper and deeper and deeper. And listen, it doesn't make somebody wrong. No, every strength coach wants to be a good strength coach. Everybody wants to do well. But the more knowledge you have, and that's why I love doing what I do, because I love teaching people. Not everybody can sit in a classroom for X number of years to try to learn. So if I can shed just even a little bit of light, even if you don't understand it, hey, please have your pitchers run 40s. Nothing longer than 100, please. And give them recovery so that they can become faster. Please don't slow them down. And you can check any textbook and it's going to say this. You know, this is science stuff.
The other area, when we're talking about 12 kids, 12 and under, is it right to say that they should focus when it comes to strength training more on their body weight instead of using weights?
Well, first of all, believe it or not, if they're doing body weight stuff like a push-up, it can be ugly because they don't know how to control their bodies. So that sounds good. Mm-hmm. That what you're saying is don't have them have weapons in their hands, you know, like dumbbells. But the truth is taking a 10-year-old with the right dumbbell, let's say, and again, you have to be under the supervision, not of a parent, probably a professional. But if the kid is using a weight and he's got to have perfect posture and the weight isn't challenging him, he can learn to do some really great things with his body. But it is very individual as to if that child should be lifting weights. He might be using a weight, but he's not lifting weights. You see what I'm saying? He might be working out. But the idea, like if you're saying, should he run and do jumping jacks? Yes. Can he do a push-up? It'd be great if he could, but you got to teach him how to do it right. And it's not that easy.
Right.
So it depends on the professional. But a good professional who works with kids, they don't just pick that profession either. Good strength coaches that work with you, they're gifted at doing that. And they know exactly what the child should be doing. But body awareness should come as early as possible. We shouldn't let our 10-year-olds do not run correctly or not know how to bend over correctly, or just because their bodies are jello, we should protect them when they're doing sports. You know, teach them the right way to do it.
Sure. Folks, I'm going to get your questions. I know we got some questions here on Facebook. I want to ask you about when we're talking about the complete body. You've got the movement, so you got to have proper movement. You've got to have, I'm assuming, proper strength in certain areas, right? And I know there's more than just what I just mentioned, but my question would be, with everything that we're talking about for developing a pitcher properly, where does the technology fit in? And you seem to use video different than most people. I want you to really explain that.
Okay, well, what I do is I do qualitative analysis instead of quantitative. Quantity is a number. Quality is sort of a subjective thing. You're looking more generally. It's a different type of analysis. And I do film analysis. I'm actually a troubleshooter. In other words, most of my pitchers come to me. I have pitchers that come and say, I just want to be better. But most pitchers come and they say, I have pain and what am I doing? So I do film analysis. I film them. It downloads into my computer. And then I do qualitative analysis. Because in my background, I'm looking at specific phases of the motion. I'm looking at every joint, where it's at specific phases, and I'm looking at the skills. So that's what I do. And then I come up with what is the issue that's going on. So when you look at a pitcher, and if you have any background as a coach, you might look and see a pitcher, and it might be something really obvious to you. You might say, whoa, his head, he like snaps his head to the left, common with youth pitchers, a righty, let's say. Sure. So you see, so if you didn't have any background, you might say, you might go to the kid and say, hey, you're snapping your head to the left, let's fix your head snap. Well, I'm looking to see why is he snapping his head to the left? Because I know there's a reason for it and has nothing to do with the head, because the body is a unit. So the pitching motion has skills within that skill. And so when you study analytical kinesiology, which is actually what I am, an analytical kinesiologist, you have to take every movement and break it into individual skills. And then you take those skills and break it down into each joint. And then you have to understand where those skills fit into the big motion. So what we know in movement is a problem you see here usually was created by something that happened prior to that moment. So what you see is the flaw, but it's not the cause. And to change motion, you have to change the cause. So that's what I do.
And that's a great segue into my next question, because, okay, now you've identified the issue, which is, you know, half the battle. If we don't know what the issue is, how are we going to correct it? Sometimes I agree with you. I remember in the old days, we had the guests sometimes, and it took us more time before we even tried to figure it out. Maybe we didn't even figure it out. So right. What's next now? Once you've identified it, how does the fix work?
That's an excellent question. So everybody who does coaching or teaching or whatever, so I consider myself a teacher. And because I understand the concept so well, I'm a concept teacher. In other words, you might see a strength coach in the gym teaching a squat, and they're going to just instruct them to teach a squat. I'm going to teach on a different level. I like to teach concepts. So my pitchers right now know more about the pitching motion than most pitching coaches, because I teach them, and it doesn't matter what age they are. I go through their brain to, first, I'm giving them respect. So here's something you're doing. If I'm going to come in and I'm going to try to change it, I got to respect that you're a person who's been doing something. So I need to get your attention on it, but I want to explain it to you so you get an understanding. So the first step is that the pitcher understand. And sometimes you have to give them background and say, listen, come here. I want to show you something. Give me your arm. This is what happens in the motion. And I might put his arm in a shape. And I say, now, I want you to look at the film here. You see how your arm's not in that position? Okay, now let me show you what muscle does that. And let me show you how important it is because of this, this, and that. So before you know it, we're having dialogue. He hasn't moved yet. And he's getting an understanding. Now, then I say, now your arm or shoulder's hurting because when you do this, it's tweaking this and wherever the discussion goes. Then he's like, okay, we don't even begin to change it until he has that understanding. Then the next thing I do is I design a drill or an exercise. And this is where having the background as a strength coach, having the background in structural integration that I have with posture, and then having the understanding of the motion and the way the joints work in the motion, I can design a drill or a movement that will give the pitcher the next most important ingredient, which is feel. Pitchers are kinesthetic. A lot of them learn visually, some work, but they feel things. They couldn't have that feel and do what they do with that ball if they didn't have feel. So I give them a way, I structure something where they're not going to make an error and they're going to feel something. And then when they feel it, I go, okay, now that's the feel. And then I start backing it up and integrating it into a drill, a modified drill. And before you know it, we're integrating it into playing catch and into pitching. So I back up the process. So that's different than a biomechanical analysis, which will give you, you know, pictures, tell you how many degrees you're off. For example, I look at a picture, and because I know where things are, there's a range of places you want certain body parts to be. If they're not there at a certain time in the motion when they're supposed to be, then I'm going to say it's off right here to myself. I'm saying this is off. I don't need to know that it's 5 degrees off or 10 degrees off or 30 degrees off. I, for what I do, I need to just know it's off, and then I need to make that correction. So that's different than a quantitative analysis. And they're both valuable. And I have to use quantitative sorts of knowledge to be able to even apply what I do.
Have you seen, and it's, it'd be interesting to get your take on this, you've seen Major League Baseball and other levels too, where they have changed some pitchers' arm action, you know, make it shorter because it was long. And there's been success behind it. I could use Giolito with the White Sox as an example of it. You could see two angles when he, you know, when his arm was longer, and then they shortened it up and he was more successful last year with it. Is that something common? You change the arm angles? Like, that goes back to the body movements, right?
Well, what I do is if I see that an angle is off, let's say I see that, okay, so if you would say that, if you would want to change a pitcher's arm, it must be because it's too long or too short at a certain time in the motion. So instead of saying we're changing this angle, the change in the angle should be a byproduct of doing the movement before it correctly. So for example, if a pitcher comes out of the glove and his timing is correct and he comes up into his early coughing position correctly, that's going to create a certain angle. Well, if he comes out of the glove like this or in some strange way, it's not going to look right. So it's not, you see that the angle is off, but it's the way he's getting there that's probably off. So it's a different way of approaching it. Now, pitching coaches, especially at higher levels, amazing eyeballs. You know, there's nothing that's going to replace the eyeball test. To me, data and everything else, if it looks wrong and it is wrong, you're probably wrong. You know, the eyeball test is important. They don't even know sometimes what they're doing, but they'll go, that arm is off, and they'll go and directly change that. And yes, they can have good luck with it. I work a different way because my knowledge base is different.
All right, the other area I want to kind of go in, I'm getting a little feedback, I think we're okay. The other area was, you know, the big area, obviously, and you mentioned there's a lot of injuries going on now. I noticed that, you know, you spoke at the American Sports Medical Institute 3 times, and one of the areas, one of the topics was connecting dots between pitching motion and the UCL injury. This relates to, because players are throwing a lot harder now, and the UCL can only maintain so much velocity in it. Can you explain what?
Right. Well, the scientists that spend their days in a laboratory, thank God they do this, they measure the strength of ligaments. And what they know is that the ligament, the amount of strain that it can take is way less than the strain it's enduring during the pitching motion. So we already know it's vulnerable. Okay, so that's the first thing we know. The second thing we know is that when you deliver the ball in the acceleration mode, the shoulder is the main joint that's delivering the force. The energy is transferred to it, but it goes from the shoulder through the elbow into the wrist. The wrist is the very last joint that applies the velocity to the ball. So it's going from the shoulder to the elbow to the wrist. So the elbow is under tons of strain, and because of the position of the elbow, you have forces coming in at it that make it vulnerable because of the position that it's in. So what we want to see in the pitching motion are angles that, one, keep the ligaments most taut and most strong, so you're not doing something strange. And the other thing we want to do is make sure that you are not decelerating incorrectly, which puts more strain on the arm. So the UCL has to be protected through strength of the muscles surrounding it so they don't get fatigued, because if they get fatigued, then that ligament's hanging there on its own. But also we want to see actions. This is what we do when we say efficient actions. We want certain angles and certain things to happen that allow that arm to be strong where it needs to be strong, and then to slow down in the way that it needs to slow down. So you're not just beating it back and forth every time you pitch. And what I also do is I make sure, I mean, my guys train their elbow joints and their forearms like crazy, because I want to be sure that that muscle stays strong enough. So when you're connecting the dots between mechanics and UCL injuries, there are certain mechanical things that pitchers do that can create a huge problem for themselves. And so in that presentation, one of the things I talked about is hooking. When a pitcher like Tanaka, Giolito was doing it for a while, hooking is a flexion of the wrist when you don't need to do it. And if you're flexing it, it's making the forearm tight. So your forearm is getting stress from this thing you're doing that you don't need to do. But because the pitcher's in the glove and his wrist is bent, he might not know he's just coming out of the glove like that. And now you've got forearm stress unnecessarily. So now how many pitches is he throwing? Let's say he throws his pen in between pitches. Let's say he's a starter. They were up around 200 pitches. And he played catch. Now he's doing that the whole time. Well, now his forearms just plain old getting tired. I mean, just do wrist flexions just like this and your forearm will be pumped up and tired in a minute. All right, so if a pitcher has that, so let's say he says, my forearm's tired and he hooks, that's what you change. You change the hooking. That gives him the relief. But again, you're seeing him hook and he's showing the hitter the ball, et cetera. You got to go to the source of it. You know, where does he hook? When does he hook? Is it in the glove? Does he come out of the glove like this, or does he stay straight and then hook? And I just had to do this for a coach. He had exact thing, forearm problems, show me his film, always hooking. Let's just determine where he's hooking, and that's where you make the change. And you just tell the pitcher, and guess what? He's all in because his forearm doesn't hurt. And he's not on the IL. You just say, throw this way. And he's like, it didn't hurt. Throw your way. It hurts. Now he knows, oh, I can do it. It's not going to hurt. And then it turns out great. So you make the connection. So hooking was one of those. So that whole presentation was on, we can start to eliminate problems with the UCL by making sure they're not doing some of these unnecessary things that don't change them as a pitcher, but keep extra stress away. So now you're just dealing with the normal amount of stress that the arm is under.
Love it. Angel, also, you know, the other part is everybody's different. So I have to assume that to change something depends on how much work that person puts into it, because we really don't know when that change is going to occur.
Exactly. Yeah, changing mechanics depends, first of all, the pitcher has to be completely into it. He has to want it. Pitchers that are hurting are highly motivated. Pitchers that are good but doing something wrong, like there's some pitchers that I watch, and I've got a pretty high prediction rate with major league pitchers. I can see they're great, and it's scary because they're so good, and they're throwing strikes. But I know darn well their low back's hurting, something's hurting. Mm. And then sure enough, they end up injured. So the pitcher has to want it. He has to somehow feel that it's not going to change who he is. You know, pitchers are like golfers. They don't really know how they're doing what they're doing. And just because they had a great game, they're not sure they're going to do it again. Unless they know what they're doing, because pitchers aren't usually aware of how they do what they do. And my whole thing has always been to make pitching something tangible to them so they understood their motion, so that they could really repeat it intentionally and then believe in it. You know, we always say in baseball, trust your stuff. And usually we're saying, trust your pitch. You know, trust that changeup. Trust it. Let it go. Don't hold back. Don't try to create the pitch. Just throw it. Well, I say trust your stuff, meaning trust your body. Know where it goes. There is an actual way that the pitching motion, that you move through it. I know it looks abstract to everybody, and it looks like it's one big blur. But there's actual specific shapes that when they occur, you can see it in the motion. And if a pitcher understands that, then he starts to be more in the driver's seat. That way, when something comes up, he's not afraid to want to make an adjustment. And adjustments, if they're the right adjustment, should make the pitcher smile like he's never smiled before. And it should not affect the pitch other than in a good way. Pitchers that aren't locating and pitchers that are hurting, there's reasons for this. It's not as abstract as everybody thinks. And my job is to help them understand that.
I'm going to get into a minute here, but let me put the psychology aspect of it where it comes into. But before we do, you mentioned something about earlier. If I remember correctly, and sometimes this time my mind went blank for a second, but you mentioned, movements, proper movements. And you said that the eyes usually tell you, it looks good or it doesn't look good. So better
do some eyeball test.
Yeah. Eyeball test. Now, my eyeball test, a lot of times on television, I'm looking at pitchers, pretty good pitchers sometimes, and, they're throwing, but then they're spinning off the one foot to the left. Or I look even some Japanese pitchers in Japan, not necessarily the ones that always come here in the States. They'll throw and their body pretty much stays where they throw. They don't continue forward that much. Now I'm going on Greg Maddux. When I watched Greg Maddux, his body was going in one direction. He almost took 2-3 hops after he threw because he had to catch himself a little bit. He's probably the guy that threw more strikes than anybody in the game. So when I see this spinning going on, but yet the player's still not hurt. Is something happening that we're not seeing that's correct?
Well, I think this is so funny that you're bringing this up because people ask me, what's the first thing you look at when you look at a pitcher? And I look at the way he finishes. If he's falling off and he can't control, there's some pitchers that have finishes that are beautiful. There's a lefty that I can't think of. It is unreal. Their finishes. When you see a pitcher follow through and he comes up and he's in control over that front leg, it's gorgeous. But when you see someone spin off and fall off, and what I'm saying is they're not in control in the middle of their motion. This isn't right. And I've said this a million times on the podcast. This is the difference in driving your car into a wall to stop it instead of using the brake to stop it. And to me, and the deceleration phase is so intense for the body. It is where you can get hurt the most.
Go ahead. I want to stop you just for a second, only because of the importance of it. And I think it's a great analogy, that we're not going forward. We're going to the left a little bit. In what area, when a player's going forward, and you have the deceleration, because the deceleration is where most of the injuries seem to be occurring from. Explain why the deceleration is so important and what's the best way for that to occur?
Well, there's deceleration going on all the levels. So first of all, the pitcher does not fall at the bottom of the mound and roll towards the hitter on the ground, right?
Right.
So he decelerated. Okay. You know that. His arm didn't fly out of his body, and so that had to decelerate. So you've got so first of all, pitching, let's picture a pitcher starting from the stretch, because even from the windup, he ends up looking like he came from the stretch, right? The knee lift is to the side. He's going sideways, Let's take, are you a righty, Pete?
Yes.
Okay, so take a righty pitcher. He's going sideways down the mound. Let's pretend you're standing behind the rubber. So you're in the outfield, but you're real close to him, so you're watching him. Okay, he's sideways. He strides down the hill. He makes a right. His body turns to the turns towards his right. He's turning. And now he's facing the hitter, so he's going straight forward. He really isn't going to the left. He isn't really going to the right. He made a nice clean turn, and now he's facing straight on like you and I are facing straight on, and then he goes forward. When he goes forward over his legs, in order to do all of that and to accumulate all the speed, which he did through his rotation, I mean, think about somebody who's trying to throw something far, standing, just playing around in the yard. You're going to spin around and then throw it. While the pitcher's spinning, he's gathering angular velocity, it's called, and then he goes forward. So his low back has to decelerate his trunk. That way he doesn't fall on his chest. And his bicep, his upper flexors, and I don't even think it's the bicep, but we'll say flexors, are decelerating the arm. The rear deltoid is decelerating the arm. The back of the shoulder is decelerating the arm, meaning I'm throwing so hard this way, something in the back of me has to pull me back this way. It has to pull the structures back. So you've got deceleration in the back of the arm. You've got deceleration in the front of the arm. And so the pitcher is coming around. He wraps his arm through the follow through, and his back has decelerated his trunk. The rear shoulder has started to decelerate the arm, and then the arm releases, and then he ends up standing up. That's all deceleration, and that's deceleration from acceleration. And he's on one leg, and he's going forward. So now you've also got gravity working, because it's trying to pull you down to the ground. That's why pitchers have to be so strong, because you see, pitching isn't running down the hill. They have to stride down the hill with control, stop that foot, but be intense in their head, and then turn and let everything come out through the shoulder. This is why it's such an awesome skill. Now, that's why you see crazy strides and you see crazy follow throughs. When I see a crazy follow through, I don't like it. I know something's going on prior to that follow through. And usually the guys that have weird follow throughs, they end up having something happen to them. Things happen to a weird follow through. So I love that you see that, and it doesn't pass the eyeball test. So in other words, if you took a 12-year-old who's totally fresh, and you were going to teach him the pitching motion, you wouldn't teach that. You would teach a controlled follow through, but then teach him how to apply the power where it needs to be applied, and then how to stop it when it needs to be stopped. I mean, we just don't drive down the street and go up on the curb and up into the hills. We stay on the street, right? And there is a way to do it. But I agree with you completely. I'm impressed that you actually can see that, because that's the first thing I noticed.
Thank you. The other area would be, is it fair to say that what you're talking about, when we talk about the forearm, the elbow, the shoulder, those are critical areas to make sure that they're strong enough, because we understand that the hips might be strong enough, or the thighs, and I mean, they're also a lot bigger. So are we focusing on that area and trying to balance those muscles, and also obviously trying to balance the rest of the muscles too, but it seems to be a lot more focus up there.
Well, there should be focus on everything. So when we talk about the shoulder joint, which, you know, you're thinking right now of your little shoulder here, and you're thinking of just this little place here. Your chest crosses the shoulder joint. It's a main accelerator. Your lat muscle in the back, it goes way down your back and out to that V shape. That's a main accelerator. Then you've got muscles underneath the chest and lat, which are rotator cuff muscles, and they're working to keep the bones together while the big muscles move forward. And you've got your shoulder muscles. So we say the shoulder joint, it's not just a little thing. It involves all the muscles, plus one of the arm muscles in the front goes in the labrum, one of the muscles in the back attaches in the back of the shoulder blade. So now you've got, when we talk about shoulder joint, if you said to me, well, I just want to work my shoulder joint, so what muscle should I work? You would have to work chest, lat, front deltoid, rear deltoid, middle deltoid, bicep, tricep. You just named almost all the muscles in the upper body. See what I'm saying? You have to understand anatomy to know that.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
So, all right, now let's take, you know, because we know injuries don't start, like you mentioned, I think, you know, when you're older, they start when you're real young. So let's take coaches working with young kids. Let's take, I guess the question is, what are some of the things we're doing wrong with young kids nowadays as coaches that we need to correct? Because if we continue them, they're going to get hurt eventually.
Yes, actually, I remember at one of the ASMI conferences, they were saying like the number of 14-year-olds and 13-year-olds that are having surgeries is a scary number. Yep. And they were saying that when they went in and looked at the damage, they could tell it would have been there for years. So they're thinking that the high school kids who are getting injured were getting injured when they were between 10 and 12.
Sure.
So there's a few things. First of all, you can't help somebody from hurting if they don't tell you they're hurting. Mm. So the coach has to have it be a very safe environment for giving feedback. Okay, that's the first thing. That's tough because 10-year-olds are little studs. They're worse than, I mean, they don't want to admit anything. So that's the first thing. That's a problem. You've got to make sure they have a safe environment. The other thing is they're playing so many different positions. And when you start to mix, there's three positions that are probably, when you mix somebody into all three of those, a young kid, you're setting them up for probably some injury because they're probably the toughest on the arm. And that would be, and unfortunately, the kid who is probably good at one might be the best for those other ones. Mm-hmm. We've got the shortstop, we got the pitcher, and the catcher. Those three positions together have different arm angles. So the pitching motion, you're supposed to repeat your arm angle each time. It's very safe. You know, everybody says it's so dangerous. No, it's not. But take that pitcher who's now a catcher and he's got to jump up and throw it, make a play to second. He's throwing sidearm, but now you've got the pitcher throwing overarm. Now you've got the shortstop running. He gets to the ball, he ropes it. He's got some other angle, which is you can't teach shortstop throwing, right? He's got to just get the ball somewhere, and he's got to get it fast. You combine all those angles. Now you've got one, different angles, two, lots of fatigue, and three, no recovery. So the biggest problem with youth sports is the kids aren't recovering. Next thing. So, okay, you can't help it. He's a pitcher and a shortstop. Putting him as a shortstop after pitching, that's a mistake. Hmm. Once you pitch, you're done. That should be a rule. So if you have to break the rule, put him in, have him pitch, and then he's done. Best thing, isolated at different games, but I already know they can't do it. I think coaches need to develop more players into their positions. They need to act more like major leagues. We don't put our pitchers out behind the plate after they're done pitching, do we? Nope. I mean, there's a reason for that. So with all the things we mentioned earlier that are the strain for the youth coach who can't have it the perfect way, little tiny decisions about, okay, this guy, he's going to do both. How can I make it the best? I mean, the pitcher-catcher combination is deadly. When they interviewed pitchers, like when ASMI did this interview with tons of pitchers, they all had been catchers also. So that is why actually Dr. Andrews came out and said, first three reasons pitchers get injured. First, playing on more than one team. Second, being a catcher.
Makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. Yes. Common sense in some ways. Angel, recovery is so critical. Okay, so we want to get pitchers recovered faster, possibly to maybe pitch maybe a little sooner, but also to reduce injuries. So what's the recovery process look like for a pitcher? And I get it. I think I've heard this before. Each pitcher is individual. You know, they may have individual programs, but what a general recovery, what are you trying to do to recover faster?
Well, first of all, it's not actually, there's part of it that's, the first part is not general. So the fibers have to recover. And that's calendar time. You know, I don't know if you've ever broken a bone, but the doctor can tell you exactly how many weeks you're going to have a cast on. Mm-hmm. And he's going to take it off. And you're like, how do you know that? Why is it? Well, we have to see. Because in science, they know how long it takes. So we know through science, and when I say we, in my field of sports science, there are geniuses that they draw blood and they look at tissue and microscope. So we know that so much damage has a certain calendar time. That's why baseball guidelines that come out make sense. So I use the original USA Baseball guidelines. So let's just talk about that for a minute. Sure. So a 12-year-old, if he throws 34 pitches today, he has to have one day of recovery for that. If he were 16, he'd have to have, he could go 39. And we know that on the next day, that night, a few hours after he's off the mound, and the next day, his fibers are torn up. So if he pitches during that time, there's two things that are going to happen. First of all, inside the muscle, there's fibers. And the fibers contract to produce the motion. Well, there's a chaotic organization going on within the muscle. So let's say we've got fiber called number 1, 2, and 3. And let's say you use 1, 2, and 3 to pitch. So the next day, 1, 2, and 3 is tired. Your body goes, your brain goes, man, we can't use them. Let's use 4, 5, and 6 because they're fresh. Well, guess what? 4, 5, and 6 might be the fibers that pull the arm down low.
Yeah.
They might be the fibers that don't rotate the shoulder exactly right. So that's why coaches can say that pitcher's getting tired. He's dropping his arm because the body is not stupid. It's so smart. So the next day, let's say you go, I'm putting that kid back in. No, it's okay. He says he's fine. Of course he says he's fine. So now you're dishonoring the calendar. And the calendar's nothing we can argue with. So you put the kid in. He's got busted up fibers. They get worse. Now he's using different fibers. Probably he's not going to pitch well. Now his nervous system hasn't even recovered. Because recovery has to happen on a muscle level, nervous system, enzymes, all this stuff. So what happens is when you've got the coach who's got three different activities going on, the pitcher pitching and not having the recovery because he's the best pitcher and the coach didn't plan the rotation right and now he's in a jam, or it's a three-day tournament and he didn't plan it right, so now he's got to have his best pitcher in again. He didn't know he was going to win. Those are some of the things that I don't think anybody can be perfect, but if you as a coach are aware and as much as possible, you try to honor some of that stuff, we can make a dent in injuries of kids. And this is particularly because the kid isn't going to come to you and say, coach, my arm's tired. But again, the eyeball test, you should be able to tell. And you know what? We can tell.
Yeah, and what's amazing, and I love the science behind it, because like you said, you know, Dr. Andrews, USA Baseball, they've done a lot of research on this. So follow the research and stay with the program coaches, especially your young kids. And I stress young kids because we've talked about this on the show many times. Exactly what you said earlier about, look at the big league guys. Big league guys, I don't know of any pitchers, very rarely pitch 3 days in a row, even relievers. Well, why are you having young kids doing that? Even 2 days.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's just common sense. And I want you to add to that, but I also want you to know, we're getting close to the end here, and I want to jump a little bit in the psychology part. So I know you had something to add about that, what I just mentioned.
the psychology part.
Well, here's the question on a psychology. Where does it fit in, I guess, when it comes to training? Does you start with it right away, and how it fits into the biomechanics, the movements, the stress behind, you know, being a pitcher? Where does it start and where do you fit it in, I guess?
Okay, well, here's what I want to say about the mental game, which is really what we're talking about here. I got my bachelor's in psychology, went to graduate school to get a master's in sports psychology while I was working with athletes, and I was sure that I wanted to teach them how to stay calm in performance. And one semester before my master's was done, I got up in the middle of a class and I said, you know what? This is BS. I want to give the athlete his body and his motion. So when he's on the mound, he's not worrying about and distracted by pain, crazy feeling he just got because he fell off his follow through and his arm feels funny. I wanted to give him peace of mind because the performance on the mound is 98% mental. And I wanted him to be right there 100% present for his mental game because you cannot be thinking while you're moving. You can't be distracted by your body. So we can handle a lot of this stuff ahead of time. And to me, having that head on the mound that gets into the battle, because we got two athletes battling each other. That hitter's been practicing.
Yep.
The pitcher's been practicing. Who knows? But I can tell you one thing. I don't want my guys worrying about their left foot or their right knee, so I make them big and strong. Give them confidence in their motion so they're present for the mental game. And that is the biggest reason. So I like, and I use this saying, I like to put them in the driver's seat with their motion so they're available to play the game because we know it's mental.
Wow, does that make so much sense? Because, you know, I'm thinking, okay, we got to start training them mentally how to deal with the failures. You're going to eliminate a lot of failures by making sure their body is moving properly. They feel good. They're throwing strikes. Now you can go to the mental game when there may be an issue because they give up a couple hits, even though they may have been good pitches. They don't realize they were good pitches. They think that they did something wrong. So now it starts playing in their mind. Now comes the mental game.
Exactly. And also too, I mean, think about when you were a kid going into an exam you didn't study for. And that's a nightmare, right? Okay, you're prepared. So all my pitchers, you know, my pitchers are like little companies. I run the whole thing. They know when they're pitching, when they're playing catch, when they're training, what body parts they train, how many they're throwing. The whole thing is handled. And they've been, my best pitchers now have been doing this with me for over 10 years. So they don't like, you know, the catcher keeps counting, we know how many pitches. It's never random. It's never like, oh, should we pitch today or not? So they're always, they know their recovery. They know everything. These guys are prepared. If you're prepared, you've done the work and you lose the game, that's a whole different thing to deal with than I wasn't prepared. I was terrible. I don't know what I'm going to do. I never know what I'm doing. My guys have a system when they get to the field. They do recovery stuff immediately at the field to bring blood in, to heal all those decelerators we talked about. They have a system, and I designed a program, and it is a product that I have, the first pitch strike preparation and recovery program. They know exactly how to warm up each joint. They know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what they do when they're done. They go in the gym after they're done. They know exactly what they're doing. And so now what you've got is you're handling about 90% of the stuff that can produce that stress that takes up space because they need that space for just dealing with the fact that guess what? You're going to walk a guy. You're going to give up a home run and you're going to lose a game. But I don't want you also dealing with the whole big mess of everything. So we can obviate a lot of issues if we start really being systematic with our guys, making them conscious, the coach being conscious, and then making decisions. And we're never going to be able to control everything. That's not the objective. The objective is take care of what you can take care of. Don't be sloppy around the edges because that never works.
Love it, love it. I'll tell you what, this is some great stuff, and I love the part about the mental aspect where it really plays, and that's in the actual game, because that's where all the pressure's at, right? So,
right.
Angel, I want to ask you, and folks, remember I said go to gymscience.com. You can see it. Angel's shirt, check it out. Great stuff. I encourage it. I want to ask you two more questions. One, who did you learn from? Who were your kind of your mentors or people you researched when you got into this? And also what you do to make yourself better. You know, even though you're pretty good, obviously, you do a lot of great work, but you're always trying to learn something. Talk about those two areas.
Well, first of all, my clients are my guinea pigs and they know this, and I'm always off into something new. It's either a new muscle. Like I used to just look at the play. I mean, at the pitcher, and my catcher would tell me how the pitches are working. I started looking at the play 2 years ago, and now I'm a fanatic about grips and fingers and the thumb, and it's always kinesiology based. Mm-hmm. So like I'm not a pitching coach saying, move your finger here to make it do this. I'm like, move your finger here because I can see it's jacking up your wrist. You can't move your wrist right. I'm always improving there. My pitchers improve and I have to improve. Or they come with a problem and I've got to do research. My education that I got, the best professors, San Francisco State, I went to Cal State East Bay for a while. I had some of the best professors that spoke in concepts that taught me how to think. And because I've always been a book person my whole life, I know how to do the research. So they were some of the best, but my mentors have been my pitchers. They present the problem. I go do the research. I come back with a solution because guess what? Our body always is going to have two arms, two legs. Kinesiology doesn't change. So what changes are the circumstances. And then when you have an education, you can go and start to do the research. And that's really what I do. I'm researching something almost every day. I've got a kid that can't learn something. I never say he can't learn it. I say, I haven't said the right thing yet. And so I am constantly trying to improve. Probably no different than a baseball coach who's constantly trying to think of better practices, better plays, different things to teach, different ways to teach it.
I was looking at the questions, folks, and it looks like we answered most of the questions, even though I didn't bring up the question, but Angel answered them. One of them was, there was one question I guess we did hit on, but let's just make sure. And that is, when we're talking about pitching development, when a youngster starts pitching, there's a lot of information. You can start early, but I'm assuming, you know, you got to watch the information that you're giving that youngster.
Yeah, well, first of all, when you're dealing with a child, you have to first always figure out how does this kid learn. Now, I can tell easily, and it's somebody who's older, but is he a visual guy? Is he a left-sided guy, right-sided? Is he a math guy? I always say to the little kid, what's your favorite subject?
Yeah.
Or what do you do? So you first got to dial in that way. And then you have to teach to his level, but you also have to teach above it. Mm. You can't teach a little kid like a little kid. I teach pretty much the same way, but I have a different way that I might teach it. They can't get concepts. So you have to know your stuff so well and know what you're trying to teach that you can show them and put them in a position to feel it and to do it successfully. So it has to be simple enough. Their brains aren't developed. They don't get concepts the way I can do a concept thing with my older pitchers. So you have to make it simple. And you have to make sure it's a feel-oriented thing, but also you have to know the pitcher himself. And the other thing that I remember a great professor saying this to me, a human being can learn anything as long as they practice it enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have to give assignments, you have to dole it out, and you never teach more than one thing at a time to a child.
Coaches, hopefully you are taking a ton of notes. This is some great stuff. Love it. Angel, we're at the end here. So what I wanted to do is kind of, you know, closing statements on, you know, about, you know, something that we missed. Because, I mean, there's so much to this topic, obviously, pitching. I mean, it's a broad picture. But is there something that, you know, you wanted to mention that maybe we didn't get a chance to talk about, kind of a closing end to the show?
Hmm.
maybe to our parents and coaches some advice?
Well, here's what I think. So I think something that's important. So baseball is a business, and baseball coaches need to win games. Mm-hmm. And so baseball coaches and pitchers and everyone needs to perform. And so when we look at the major leagues, I'll see a guy who's throwing strikes and he's awesome. And everybody thinks he may be an MVP kind of guy. And baseball is about what you do. Okay. Somewhere we want to blend in a safe way how they do it. And I think baseball, I'm praying that it's moving in that direction. I thought it was going to move in that direction, but then they started bringing in data. But I think there's a place, and they're going to make room for it, where, yes, he's got to still throw these strikes. He throws strikes. So we want, this is what the pitcher does. He's got to throw strikes. But somewhere, let's weave in how he throws those strikes, so he can last longer. You see, everybody's making, this is the perfect time to say this, everybody's making this big deal about 43-year-old Tom Brady. Guess what? He's doing, this is what, how we all should be in life.
Yeah.
43 is young.
Yeah.
43 is young, but he does everything right. He stays safe, he stays on top of his game, he's got the training, nutrition, he does everything. He takes care of himself, but he believes he can, and he doesn't think he can't. But he's a how you do it guy. He isn't just what you do. It's how you do it. I'm the how person. I love that you can throw strikes, but I'm sorry. If you finish and your low back looks like it's going to blow out, and I'm talking about one of the best pitchers right now that I worry about every time I see him. This guy's got so much talent. But if I watch his low back go into that round, awful position, and he's got back problems, and nobody has said this to him, and it's too bad. But who wants to touch this guy? Because he's so filthy with everything he throws. They don't want to touch him. But so somewhere, before all our kids get that far in, let's, along the way, let's care about how somebody does something, not just what they're doing. And I think that is the message of the future. It's what I do in my business now. And if that guy hurts his back, he'll be wanting to hear what he should do right.
Absolutely.
Let's try to get to it before he hurts his back and let him keep going those strikes.
You know, Angel, that's a great message, great way to end it. And I'll tell you what I like about it too, is that, you know, we know this, you know, we ask this question all the time. Why are we not working smarter so that way we reduce the injury instead of working harder after the injury and go over all the rehab stuff, which is extremely difficult. The other aspect we talk about in a show all the time, I really appreciate bringing it up. You use the words long-term. We're all trying to get kids to play this game longer. And people use the excuse, you know, that kids drop out of sports because of this, this, and this. Let me tell you something. I understand certain things they might drop out of baseball because of. But I do know this. They quit early because they're no longer successful or they don't enjoy the game anymore. Otherwise, if we did some of these things really well, they would play longer, because why would a kid not that's enjoying something he really loves not want to play longer if he's good at it?
Yes. Yes. No, I agree. And these, and you know, men who are in the major leagues, in the minor leagues, I see what my 23-year-olds go through in the minor leagues. This is their job. Mm-hmm. This is no different than a job you have or I have. We want to keep it. And the thought that, oh, you're old when you're 28?
Yeah.
No, it's insane. These guys should be getting better. Every time they pitch, they should be getting better. And you notice we don't always see that, right? We don't always see the guy. He's, oh, he threw 90 when we drafted him, and now he's throwing 95. That's how it should be. That's why we have to care a little bit more and maybe catch it sooner, so they're not already on the major league mound going, whoa, if I change something, will I still be able to do it? So I think that this is, yes, let's be the 43-year-old pitchers.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, let's be the guy who goes and gets it done. And let's engineer that generation now. That's what I'm trying to do.
Love it. Love it. I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate it. It's been a great show.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor to be with you.
All right. That is Angel Borelli. Listen, check her website out, gymscience.com. I keep looking to my right when all I got to do is look at you. You got it written on your shirt. gymscience.com. Get a hold of Angel. Check out her podcast. You'll see everything on her website. I went through the website. It's outstanding. And don't forget, do us a favor. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo. Go to the podcast, Baseball Outside the Box. Subscribe. Tell your friends about the show. Tell anybody that's in the game of baseball at any level. We'd love to hear from them. Don't forget, special thanks to our producer, Brian Crock, with the Lineup Media Group. Special thanks to all of you in the U.S. and around the world for joining the show. And remember, be healthy, stay safe, God bless you, and we will see you on the next show.